Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. What turns an ordinary woman into a legend? In Louisiana, with such an astounding number of living legends walking amongst us, you'd almost think it's something in the water down here. This week, we're going to take an in-depth look at women who've conquered life's challenges and become legends in their own time. Media darling Terry Fletcheridge Rowe was a pioneer of radio and television here in New Orleans. As she approaches her centennial birthday, Terry remembers a life well spent and relates some previously untold tales about her behind-the-scenes influence on the culinary world. Culinary giant, 93-year-old Leah Chase, is the 2016 James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award winner. Leah takes us back to her childhood in Madisonville to tell us about how her amazing character and work ethic were shaped virtually from birth. Then, we look outside of Louisiana and learn how La Varenne's Ann Willen achieved legendary success on both sides of the pond. It's all women and all winners on this week's Louisiana Eats. Did you grow up in the 1950s, a fan of Miss Muffin on WDSU-TV in New Orleans? Or did you spend your lunchtime with Terry Fletcheridge on the Midday Show? It might surprise you to learn that even Chef Paul Prudhomme's life was forever changed by Terry. Here's living legend Terry Fletcheridge Rowe to tell us all about it.
I was born in Omsk, Siberia, right into the Russian Revolution. My mother was a dentist, very well known in Omsk. My father was a scientist and very well known. But when I was three, when the communists came, they chose him to start the first Soviet-Chinese trade mission. And after he was there, he sent for my mother, my older sister, and me. And it took us 6 months.
To travel there?
Yeah, to get from Omsk to Tomsk to Moscow, then Vladivostok, then Harbin, and then finally to Shanghai. It took us 6 months.
Oh, goodness.
But I was very lucky because I was the youngest one on the train. And the conductor took me to the front of the train so I could see everything. And I did. I went to Huzhou Dashui, the University of Shanghai, and I graduated 37. But when I graduated, my folks gave me a little Austin. There was a beautiful hotel, the Park Hotel, so I would drive there, and they had music. It was almost wartime, and there were Navy people and Army people there, and there were some students from the university. So the girls would love to come and dance with the Marine soldiers. I loved the music, and I would go to dance there. And I asked the band leader, "What music is that? It just carries me away." He said, "That's jazz." "Oh, okay. And where does it come from?" "Comes from New Orleans." So I was determined. I wrote in my diary, "I am going to New Orleans." That's what brought me here. I read an ad in the Times-Picayune when I was on the plane, actually, and I saw that there was an apartment available in the quarter. And it was 732 St. Peter.
Yes.
And you know what that address is.
No, what is that address now?
You don't go to Preservation Hall.
So you come to New Orleans, and there's jazz music everywhere. Yes. And you come here as a young career woman.
Right.
And from the very start, you were in media.
I think it was WDSU radio.
It was WDSU.
Okay.
And you were on the radio first.
Mm-hmm.
From New Orleans, the city where jazz was born, it's the transcribed Dixieland Jam Bake. Yes, from the studios of WDSU in the heart of New Orleans.
There wasn't even television when you got here. There was only radio.
I was the first one to produce a television program in New Orleans.
And what was that show that you produced?
Midday.
It's high noon in the Crescent City and time to catch up on the news with a lot of people on Midday, 60 minutes of information and fun. Produced for you on Midday by Terry Fletcher.
Hi, and may I wish you a perfectly beautiful day, another in a long string of lovely days. I'd like to contribute this quotable clip, which you might enjoy quoting to your husband tonight.
That was a damn good show.
It was a damn good show. It was a wonderful show.
Yeah.
And I remember you, you know, whenever I was sick and I was at home from school, I got to see you on the Midday Show.
Yeah.
And imagine, you were a woman producing the Midday Show.
Minutes of Midday, WDSU's hour-long news and variety show for women. And for men, many men who care to and usually do watch. A jambalaya of ideas and talent. Midday is produced and presented by Terry Fletcher, New Orleans' favorite woman personality on television. And that, believe me, is no idle boast. For in a recent survey conducted by Trendex, Terry was chosen as the top woman personality on TV over all other local lady telecasters and all network gal performers. And I'd like to introduce you to...
You know, it's my guess that everybody in New Orleans feels like they know you because it's such an intimate thing watching television.
Yeah.
It's like you have those people in your home. People still must recognize you tremendously.
Funny they do. And some of them, they think they know me intimately because they sat on my lap.
Oh, of course, as children when you were Miss Muffin.
You still me as Mrs. Muffin?
Yes, I remember you as Mrs. Muffin.
And you know why I started that? I wanted to have a kids show because I was doing news and this and that, and I wanted to have a kids show. So I started Mrs. Muffet. Honey, see that picture of Chef Paul behind there?
I'll tell
you about Paul Prudhomme.
Okay.
He had seen me on television, but we had a lovely African-American woman who was on the show.
Lena Richard.
Right. And so when he came to New Orleans as a kid from Opelousas, he came to see the show. And then he said, "How long have you had her?" And I said, "Well, quite a while." He said, "Well, I'd love to cook on your show, but you've got her. Can you help me in some other way?" And I said, "I hope I can. I live right across from Brennan's restaurant, biggest restaurant in town. So come have lunch with me there, because we already had a cook." And so he came, and then I introduced him to Ella, and away he went.
Photograph right here of you and Paul. What's going on in that photograph?
I think I interviewed him on Mrs. Muffin about things that kids can do well, like cookies.
Uh-huh.
And also, Mrs. Muffin served birthday cookies to the birthday children, and we'd write their names on them, so I gave him one too.
So, who made the cookies on Miss Muffin?
I think I did. I love to cook.
And, of course, you wrote that adorable book, The House in the Bend on Bourbon Street.
Yeah.
You wrote that book about the house where you lived
mm-hmm.
with your husband, the artist, Lenny Fletridge, mm-hmm. and your son. So who were some of the people who crossed the threshold at the House on the Bend of Bourbon Street?
Well, I think when we had anyone who came to town, Isaac Stern, what's wrong with that? And he was a very good friend of Lenny's from New York. And so we entertained him a lot. On midday, when I interviewed interesting people, and they had a few days to stay here, I interviewed them.
Was there a particular meal that you liked for out-of-town guests to enjoy?
Yeah, frequently I made borscht. You know what that is, the Russian soup?
Yes.
And pirashki.
I'm sure that must have been quite a surprise to people coming to see you in New Orleans.
Right.
Borscht and pierogi would have been two of the last things I think they would have expected. And where did you get that love of cooking?
I guess Shanghai. We had a Chinese cook, and his wife was my ama. But he was a Chinese cook, and he cooked Russian food. Pelmeni, pierogi, borscht, all of that.
And then you leave New Orleans after Mr. Fletchridge passed away.
Yeah, yeah.
You go to Maine and you become the head chef at your inn. You're cooking at your own inn?
We live right on the coastline. Look it up. Hancock, Maine. And then Chef Paul came and helped us start the kitchen going. You know who Teresa Torkanovsky is?
Yes.
Okay. I was a cook. She was like a hostess. And then we had two friends of hers from Philadelphia or somewhere. And it's still going, but it's doing much better than we had it because we were a bunch of artists and idiots. You know, the best things in life happen by accident.
Yes, you just have to keep your eyes open. And
well, wait till you're a year and a half short of 100.
Oh, my goodness. It's the most amazing thing.
Well, you know what? I plan to be Great Granny Muffin on my 100th birthday.
Oh.
I called my producers, Susie Fontaine and Ellen Hardiman. She and I are talking about doing a Mrs. Muffin's 100th birthday.
Oh, well, it'll be such an event. People will come from all over. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Of course, I have been your fan my whole life, and really, thank you so much for making the time for us.
Oh, honey, thank you. I love meeting you.
Living legend and media darling, Terry Fletchridge Rowe. When we come back from a short break, culinary legend Leah Chase joins us with the story of her humble beginnings on a Madisonville strawberry farm. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Legendary superstar Leah Chase of Dookie Chase Restaurant fame grew up on a strawberry farm in Madisonville, Louisiana, the eldest of 11 children who, despite their lack of material goods, never wanted for a thing. We sat down with Leah at her restaurant to hear all about how a legend gets their start.
When I was coming up, we were so very poor. And what I'm so proud of, we were so poor. My mother had all these children, but people were kind to us. Big corporations didn't help like they help it today. And baby, that was a good thing. It made you work. It made you strive hard to get out of that poverty cycle. My daddy and his brothers would farm, and my grandfather, they would farm these 15 acres. Now, that was an ordeal then, because I remember my daddy and them have to get up. If it was cold and there was a frost to come, daddy would have to stay in the field all night long and make fires all around the field. So when the berries came, You got up in the morning at 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, we lived in Madisonville. The farm was like 5 miles out. Walked.
You had to walk?
Walked.
Oh, goodness.
Get out and pick those strawberries, 50 acres, come back home, get dressed, and go to school.
How many children did your mom and dad raise over there?
11.
11?
11. So we lived good lives. We lived off the land. We didn't have a lot of luxuries, but do you need all of that to live? Do you need all of that to be kind to people? No. I don't remember us being sad or anything, Poppy. We were never sad. And you know what? We did for one another. We had to scrub the floors on our knees and all that kind of stuff. We didn't complain about a thing. We'd sweep the yard, play hopscotch in the yard or whatever. Everybody was happy. And your treat at night was pecans. You know, they had pecan trees all around. You would peel pecans and you would play games for pecans and stupid little things. But we were so happy. We had a pig, we raised a hog for the fat. You know, you would raise this hog and you would feed the hog every day. My daddy was something. Couldn't give the hog potatoes that wasn't cooked. Wash the potatoes and cook them for the hog. The hog was living better than me. But if you fattened that hog up to 300 pounds, you were going to get about 100 pounds of fat. And that lard was going to take you through the winter. And you talk about coffee things, you know, preserved things. Well, we didn't know what coffee was, but we were eating that coffee pork.
Yeah, right.
That's how we served it. They fried off the chops and left them in the grease. And when you wanted a chop, you got it out of the grease. So we had coffee when it wasn't fashionable to have coffee. You learn how to live and you learn how to appreciate things. People talk about quail until the day. I love quail. Well, you know, you picked the strawberries, the quail got in your strawberry patch. What you did? Shot him. And that was your breakfast, you know. You had a plum tree in the yard. Your mother made plum jelly and braised that little quail with plum jelly, and there you had that. Now that was a luxury. You see, my dad would raise, he never raised just enough for us to eat, because that wasn't right. You had to give the neighbors, and he was a stickler. We didn't have a penny, we didn't have that. But go give the neighbors this, give our teen this, give this one that. But to preserve that, we didn't have freezers in those days. So he made us slice the okra, slice it up, and then my mother had flour sacks or that you bleached out white, and you, we'd spread those out on the table in the sun, put that okra out there every day. Sunday dinner was stewed chicken. You didn't have chicken every day. You had chicken on Sunday. It could either be stewed chicken, fried chicken, baked macaroni for sure. If you had enough money to buy meat, you had what we call pane meat, which was veal, paneed. But you had that on Sunday. You had something going special on Sunday.
And always gumbo, right?
Always gumbo. In the summer when it was okra, you had okra gumbo. In the winter, you had whatever they had to make the gumbo with. If it was squirrels that your daddy shot or a rabbit, you had gumbo on Sunday.
With filet then in the winter?
Oh, yeah, with filet. Your mother took great pains in making that gumbo on Sunday. You know, and you never make a little pot. Nothing for us was in a little pot. They had so many of us. You'd make this big pot of gumbo. If she went down to the river or to the bayou and caught crabs, you had that in your gumbo. But she always made that good gumbo. And you sat to the table on Sunday. You sat to the table and ate, so everybody enjoyed it. That was really good.
Now, y'all also would go down to the river or the bayou and catch fish.
Well, that was the funny thing. My mother loved to fish. You know, my mother, she always had a heart problem. I never remember my mother taking a Valium or anything like that. If we got on her nerves, she said, go dig me some worms. So here we are putting soapy water down to bring the worms up and put them in a can with some dirt on them. She'd take her fishing pole, go sit on the bayou and fish. That was her relaxation, to sit on the bayou and fish. And it was a simple, simple life. But I don't remember any of us being unhappy. Life in Madisonville taught me the basics. If you walk through the woods, you know what berry you can eat, you know what you can't eat. You know what you can touch, what you can't touch. So you learn basic rules coming up in the country. You're not afraid to kill a chicken because you're going to kill it to eat it. You know everything about food. And you learn how to create different things with simple food. I got the Native Son Award for St. Tammany Parish. Now, who would have thought this poorest of poor little girl coming up would grow up to get the Native Son Award? That is a blessing. But that just shows you, you just work every day, have faith in God, have faith in yourself, and you can pull it off. You can pull it off and treat everybody fairly. You take the Civil Rights March. Take King. In 1960, King did this big march on Washington. That was tried before, my darling, in the 1940s by A. Philip Randolph. He couldn't get it done. 20 years later, King comes. Different time. It makes a difference in what you can do. Time makes a difference. Everything is according to time. So you do the best you can do, and then somebody else will carry it on, you know. And you don't get angry. You can say, I started this. So what? You started it. But somebody had to finish it.
Yeah.
So sometimes you might start a thing, and somebody builds on it, and that's what life is all about. I'm a believer in God, you know that. And when things happen like Katrina, it's for a purpose. It's for a purpose. You know, you see people come back, and I'm trying now to get my takeout back because what I lost there is my neighborhood, and I don't want to lose that. I want the neighborhood to be able to come here and say, I can buy a portion of potatoes for my children, a treat, a sandwich, and I'm going to get that back. I really am going to get that back. The neighbors I had before, they helped me along. They would take care of me. So I want that. I don't want them to think that, look, she came back and she's outgrown. I never want to outgrow people. How do you outgrow people? You need people. We need everybody. I don't care. You can be the president. You can be the pope. But it's that little man that keeps that cog in the wheel going. You need him too. And that's what we have to do. And I think that's what we're doing good in this city. We're making everybody feel their worth. Look at life different and learn to appreciate life more. You know, I come in here every day. I'm slower than what I used to be, but that's okay too. You meet people, you're able to talk to people. People help you. You help them the best way you know how. And that is a wonderful thing, Poppy. And when I see people like you who scuffle, rise above it all, that's what women are supposed to do. That is the important thing, man. And that's what I try every day to make people understand. about the power of women. If you just act like a woman, how powerful you can be, the wonderful things you can do just being a woman. So I tried to do that all the time, and it really works. We have to live our lives for ourselves sometimes. You can't live other people's life. I've learned that. It took me a long time to learn that. You know, why don't you do this? Why? You can't make people do what they don't want to do. If you want to change anything about you, you have to do it yourself. It's what you did for self, what you did to better the whole world you live in. You are important to do things. And if everybody does what he's supposed to do, it makes a difference. No matter what you do, make a difference. You know, you can earn all the money in the world, darling, but if you don't make a difference in this world you live in, you're wasting your time. You've got to make a difference and help somebody else along the way.
But I just won't let it get me down. Won't let it get me down. Because this whole world, it just keeps on going around.
Leah Chase, winner of this year's James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award. One of the character traits that every legend must possess is bravery. My friend Leah Chase is one of the bravest women I've ever known. Not only did she undertake the rebuilding of her restaurant, Dookie Chase, after Hurricane Katrina, she lived across the street in a FEMA trailer while doing so. I don't think anything scares Leah. Once, I helped her make some crab soup, but I wasn't brave enough to tackle those live crabs. To begin, Leah dumped a bushel of live blue crabs into a deep sink and plunged right in with bare hands to clean them. That means she was pulling off their top shells while they were still alive and trying their best to get hold of her with those scary, big, snapping crab claws. Okay, I'm not trying to scare you away from making her incredible crab soup. Use frozen gumbo crabs already cleaned, or put those live crabs in the freezer for a while before cleaning them. Trust me, that'll calm them down. Once the crabs are clean, they're fried in some oil and set aside. Onions, celery, and bell pepper are added to the crab cooking oil and sautéed until translucent. Then garlic, thyme, cayenne, paprika, and parsley are added to the pot with water and those crabs. Everything simmers together for about 30 minutes, and then lump crab meat is stirred in to finish the soup. Just like everything Leah cooks, this one is delicious and well worth the effort. You'll find Leah's original recipe on our website at itsneworleans.com and wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Leah Chase's crab soup is some real Louisiana eats. British-born Ann Willen is founder of the prestigious La Varenne Cooking School, which operated in Burgundy, France from 1991 until 2007. She's a celebrated author as well as a cooking teacher who's won two James Beard Cookbook Awards. With her books available in 35 different languages, there's little doubt Ann Willen is an international legend in her own lifetime. We had the honor of speaking with Anne about her life and her work. Tell me about starting La Varenne, and tell me about the life's path that took you that way.
Well, it was quite a winding path. Goodness. I was born in Yorkshire, in England, in the heart of the countryside, just before World War II. I had a very classic English education, boarding school, Then 3 years at Cambridge University, where I graduated in economics. And in those days, 1959, we were only 2 women among 100 men in the class, and there was nothing for a woman to do with a degree in economics. So I cast about a bit because I really wanted to get a job. And I went to teach needlework and dressmaking. The school was affiliated with the Cordon Bleu in London. I went then for a 3 month advanced course. They asked me to stay on to teach, and the rest really is history, though it's bounced around from Paris to New York to Washington, D.C., and back to Paris again when I found in Love RN.
Well, there are many people who I'm sure wish they could time travel back to before 2007 when you closed Love RN. Would you talk to us about the Love RN experience, what it would have been like to have the opportunity to study with you there?
Well, we were always very hands-on. So students, and we took quite a lot of trainees too, were always in the kitchen doing things, cooking, and all the teaching was done not by me, but by French chefs, because I still feel strongly that there are wonderful culinary roots in technique and approach to cooking that you really still, I don't want to be too categoric, but you find very strongly in France. And so I wanted all the teaching to be done by French chefs in French, because it's different if you try to teach in a foreign language. When you're talking about something that you love in your own language, it comes across much more vividly.
Yes, you can hear that passion. Let's get back to your book, Anne. It's a little book. It's not the gigantic tome that you would expect if you were going to have all your secrets locked up in one book. How did you make the selections, and what's the most challenging thing between those pages?
The selection made itself. It dates right back to the beginning of the school, when we found we were handing out basic recipes on sheets of paper all the time. And it boiled down to, it turns out in fact, to be 50 recipes. But it's things like choux pastry and pie pastry and meringue and white sauce. And what you need is the method, of course, but above all, the proportions. And this little book, we gave to every Love RN student, and an amazing number of them have kept the little book. Because when you want to make a medium white sauce that's going to coat your bit of fish or whatever it is, you can look up what you need, and it's all in this little book.
During your time running Love RN, were there ever any hopeless students?
Oh, yes. Oh, dear. There were, of course, the wrong people in the wrong place. And they shouldn't have been there in the first place. Possibly in the early days, their parents had hoped that they might pick up some cooking would be useful in later life. There were a few of those, but the ones that were really sad were the ones who really, really wanted to cook and simply didn't get it. And you kind of, even now, when a trainee walks into the kitchen, I know within 5 minutes if they're going to, A, really enjoy it, but B, have that kind of empathy for food and creating things with food that makes a really good cook. And the instance I give is a trainee we had, and we kept the food locked in the cellar, and though it was an ancient cellar and had only one key. The key got lost.
Oh, no.
The trainee had lost it. We looked all over. Nice guy. He tried to help. It was finally found. He dropped it from his pocket into the bucket of stock.
Oh, no.
Now, I mean, you know, it is.
How does that even happen?
Poor guy. He was mortified. Anyway, all's well that ends well. We were able to open up shop. But, you know, some people just don't understand quite why you whisk in a figure of eight and that sort of thing.
What advice would you have for aspiring cooks, home cooks, aspiring chefs? What's the best advice you can give them?
Don't be nervous. Just go into the kitchen, start cooking, and you'll very quickly realize what it's all about. Get a good cookbook. You might want Secrets from the Labyrinth Kitchen, but you also probably will want to look at some television programs. Now, one thing I think, or one principle, is very important. Use local ingredients. Go to the local open market. Look around in nearby restaurants. Goodness me, in Louisiana, you have wonderful, wonderful examples of delicious and very individual dishes.
And on any given night, if you were to go into the kitchen and say, tonight, I'm going to make my favorite dinner. What is Ann Willen's go-to favorite meal?
It's very simple. We have it quite often. It's butter roast chicken.
Butter roast chicken.
Yeah.
And where will we find that recipe?
Oh, you won't actually find it in The Secret. It's very simple. You generously slather a fresh farm-raised chicken with butter. You sprinkle with salt and pepper. You put a bundle of herbs like possibly bay leaf and parsley, perhaps a slice of onion in the middle, and you just leave it to cook peacefully. It'll make a little noise. It'll make a little
And it'll also make some delicious scents come out of the kitchen, won't it?
Yes, it certainly will. Keep basting it with the butter. It'll be done when you take hold of the two legs and try wiggling them. And if they don't resist you, if they just almost fall away from the bone, it's done, and you have absolutely delicious juice to make gravy.
Oh, I'm hungry. I think I'm having butter roast chicken for dinner tonight. I cannot begin to thank you enough for spending this time with us today on Louisiana Eats and for sharing not just the secrets from the La Varenne kitchen, but some secrets from Ann Willen's kitchen herself. So thank you, Ann.
That was just lovely to talk to you about our favorite subject, Poppy.
Ann Willen, whose latest book is Secrets from the La Varenne Kitchen, available in bookstores everywhere. What are the famous mother sauces? Stay tuned, and we'll explore that topic when we come right back. I'm
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What are the famous mother sauces? In the 19th century, the great French chef Carême designated bechamel, velouté, espagnole, and tomato sauce as the building blocks for all other sauces. Later, hollandaise joined the family. All sauces share one characteristic. They must have a proper viscosity in order to cling to food, or sauce it, as we Americans might say. To achieve this, four of the five mother sauces begin with a roux, a combination of butter and flour that thickens liquids. The fifth, hollandaise, is an emulsified sauce, which means that it's thickened by mounting butter into an emulsification with lemon juice and egg yolks, which is also the case with béarnaise, a derivative of hollandaise. Speaking of derivatives, once you've covered the mothers, you've got the others, offshoots of the core group. In Louisiana, our most common sauce derivatives include remoulade, ravigote, bordelaise, and of course, cocktail sauce. For a full investigation into sauce cookery, pick up a copy of Anne Willen's Secrets from the La Varenne Kitchen. With Anne's book in hand, sauce making won't be a secret anymore. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. What you wanna? Ella Brennan holds a special legendary distinction in New Orleans culinary history. Much has been written about this celebrated restaurateur, but what an honor and a pleasure it was to sit down with Ella in her home, just steps away from Commander's Palace, to hear her story in her own words. Ella's legacy began with her older brother Owen, a visionary man she clearly adored. As a child, and into her adult years, wherever Owen was, Ella was never too far behind.
I followed him around as a little girl. He was 15 years older than I was. And I remember going to pick up my father at the ferry where my father would come home to work. He'd take me with him. I spent the years from high school through that time working with him because he was always interested in making sure I learned how to do something. He wanted the family to be in a business so we could take care of our mother and father in their late years. And so he all of a sudden one day bought a restaurant.
That restaurant Owen bought in 1946 would eventually become known as Brennan's. With encouragement from her brother Owen, Ella would go on to learn from the restaurant chef Paul Blanger.
I spent a tremendous amount of time with Paul Blanger on Sunday mornings when the restaurant was closed. And I would go down, because Paul wanted to go in and fill with the stock pots and the da-da-da-da-da-da, and we would sit down and have these massive cups of coffee. Paul had some of these wonderful two old cookbooks, which he eventually gave to me, and I kept them close to me because I was using them constantly. So Paul helped me with, he would go make one or two of these various dishes, and we'd say, oh, we can't do that, we can't do that, we can't do that. So we kept evolving what we could do.
Ella Brennan's education continued evolving, too. Owen sent her across the United States and Europe to learn the restaurant business firsthand from the greats. When Ella moved to Commander's Palace in 1974, she immediately got to work, bringing in a number of now famous American chefs, beginning with Chef Paul Prudhomme.
Paul, coming from the Bayou, was doing his version of what they were doing down in the Cajun country. And we started melding them together. And I kept saying, Paul, it's got to be a little bit lighter. It's got to be a little bit lighter. But basically, he's one of the most natural cooks you'll ever find. It's in him. I talk about magic in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
They either have it, or they don't. And what do I mean by that? It's what they're going to put in. I mean, it's the seasoning, it's the selection of the dish to begin with, the raw material, what are they going to serve. And if they have this magic in their hands, they can take this wonderful dish and wow.
When Paul Prudhomme left Commander's to open his own restaurant, Ella had to search for a new great talent, and she found it in Emeril Lagasse.
I'll never forget when we were looking for Emeril, because Paul wanted to leave, and I really wanted a chef. I wanted somebody who could take that kitchen and really organize it better, even than Paul could do at that time. And so along came this recommendation for Emeril. And I told the man, no, he's too young, doesn't have the right experience. Don't bring him down because I'm rejecting him now. Don't bring that young man down here and have me face to face have to reject this kid. He said, bring him down anyway. So he brought him down. And that's how we got.
The kitchen at Commander's Palace became a great incubator for budding chefs. That's the place legendary Jamie Shannon honed his chops.
Well, when Jamie got here, he was working in the kitchen. Emeril took him on. And so Jamie was there. And when Emeril got ready to leave, I'll never forget, we had four guys we could take as chef. Any one of them could have done the job. Emeril said, that's the one. That's the one. He was just one of talk about magic in his hands.
So how is it that Ella Brennan had such great success in finding that magic and creating a lasting culinary legacy?
Well, I don't know how you do that. I mean, it just sort of, you go with your instincts. I mean, you go with what you feel, this person, how they talk to you about what they're doing, how they go fix something, and you see how they handle themselves in a kitchen, and you talk to them about how they want to run a kitchen, and you feel it, you really feel it in your gut. And you say, okay, this one. And I realized what absolutely fantastic mentors I had. Absolutely fantastic. The cooks, and then there was my older brother and sister, Adelaide and Owen. She mentored him, he mentored me. I mean, it was all each teaching each other, and I finally began to realize that's what it was all about. So when, in addition to running the restaurant, you could build these people and this team. And when they all realized how much they could do together and help each other and make, we have a school. We've been teaching for years now. When they sit down, we ask them where they want to go. And if they sound like they're interested in something or they have some ideas, we try to progress with that.
The legendary Ella Brennan of Commander's Palace.
You've got the magic touch. It makes me glow so much.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when Episcopal High School junior Martine Cruz explains to us how she's challenging Baton Rouge teens to think differently about their drinking water.
But the thing is most kids aren't going to listen to you. They're going to listen to their parents, and they're going to eat and drink what their parents are putting in front of them. So it's like, teenagers will listen to you, and they make their own choices already, so maybe I should be focusing more on a demographic of teens.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans' French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.